I'm so happy to be here on a Tuesday night. I'm almost never attending Tuesdays, though I want you all to know I watch the recordings. I'm here on the East Coast, so it's a little bit later past my bedtime, but happy to be here and see some new faces. And I'm almost always here on Sunday chanting service, so this is a real nice change, and I'm happy to present tonight. On Do Not Become Intoxicated, Polish Clarity, Dispel Delusion. I should also back up and just do a little bit of an introduction about myself and my involvement at Brightway. I'm Ellen T, and I live in the Philadelphia area. And like many of us in the cloud, I first learned about Brightway from Domio's podcast way back. And then when she mentioned at the start of the pandemic that she was inviting, all were welcome to attend chanting service in Zazen via Zoom, I could not believe my luck. I was very pleased with that turn of events. And I had a Zen practice for several years at that point, as well as a general secular meditation practice. But when I started participating with Brightway, it really felt like home, despite all of the miles between us. And so now I've been a member since 2020. And as a member of the board, also, I want to encourage you to become a member too if you haven't already. I thought I'd put in that plug. Since we have so many program offerings and opportunities, for real human connection, like you see here via both the dirt and cloud zendos. So take a look at the website for all of that. So thanks for being here for tonight's precepts talk. And this is our seventh in this year's series, and it's the fifth grave precept. I've really enjoyed this year's precept presentations. As I said, I've been watching the videos. And if you've missed them, by the way, those videos live on Brightway Zen's website under resources, audio and video. And all of the classes and discussions and Domio's Dharma talks are archived there. So I encourage you to listen or re-listen, whether or not you're preparing for Jukai. There's just so much there. So having covered the Karmaverse and the three refuges and the three pure precepts, we moved on to the 10 grave precepts and have arrived at Do Not Become Intoxicated, Polish Clarity, Dispel Delusion. And since it's difficult to discuss this precept without talking about addiction, I really want to make a point that I want to proceed skillfully and with great care. For anyone in recovery or contending with addiction of issues in their family or friends, I understand how terribly fraught the topic is. So I wanted to start by saying that I'm offering this talk with compassion and support. The fifth of the grave precepts, our precepts are guidelines for living an ethical life, is to refrain from use or overuse of intoxicants, which are said to cause carelessness. And, modern beliefs about this vary from school to school, from between different teachers. It's not followed to the letter, this precept, the way others might be. Mahayana Buddhist schools might maintain that it's like intoxication, not the use of intoxicants. So it's really a question of degree for some folks. So in preparing our talks on the precepts, it's natural to want to find a personal connection to the topic at hand. I've heard a bunch of my Sangha members say the same. And so at the beginning of each season, each precept season, we're asked to choose one. And this is my third presentation. So as we look for at the list of available precepts for discussion at the beginning, we hope to sign up for one that is particularly meaningful or challenging, so we can approach the topic with some individual insight and experience and anecdotes, maybe connect our stories to our Zen practice. demonstrate that connection, though maybe it's not linear or consistent throughout our lives. Maybe it's a theme you've seen throughout your years or just a topic you feel strongly about. Well, let me just say the precept of do not become intoxicated was not my first choice. I'll just put that right out there and I'll tell you why. It's because I felt somewhat disconnected from it. And as such, sort of uncredentialed to lead this important discussion, especially when, as I said, it is a critical topic for many people. However, in thinking about it, I soon realized that this disconnection is merely delusion. I didn't immediately identify with the precept because of its association with addiction to specific substances that are not my own. But it's so much more than that. And I know from friends and family who have been in recovery that this can be an annoying thing to hear. Nobody wants to hear who's in active recovery about someone's addiction to sugar or other things. But anyway, I don't drink. Alcohol gives me migraines, so I avoid it. A few years ago, I was eligible for a medical marijuana card because I was undergoing cancer treatment. And I thought, oh, that'll be nice. But it wasn't. It made me distractedly thirsty. I did not enjoy it. Neither did I enjoy the narcotic pain medicine that I was given after surgery. It just kind of caused nausea. So I'm no fun. I don't party that way. And it's not that I never did. I definitely had my moments in high school and college. But now my idea of a good time is, sitting in bed reading or sitting in silence for 6 days at session. But back to that delusion of disconnection to addiction and intoxicants. And I in no way mean to imply equivalency between my identified addictions and yours. But with that said, I am absolutely addicted to certain activities that provide comfort to me. I might even say that provide sedation. I'm also addicted to sugar. I've always been addicted to sugar. It's been a force my entire life. And most of all, I'm prone to a certain habit energy of pain avoidance. Physical, yes, I'm terribly afraid of bodily pain. Mental, absolutely. I've shared with our Sangha about my lifelong experience of major depressive disorder, which for me is not so much really overt sadness most of the time, but kind of a gravity, heaviness, and also bodily pain. So treatment modalities that recognize the body and mind as one are of interest to me. A lot of that led me to doing yoga and meditation back in the 90s and then gradually into a Zen practice. But I also want to emphasize, I don't view personally Buddhism as a self-help program. I think it was Mark said that as well. As much as a world health problem program, I should say. Buddhism isn't a self-help program, but it helps. The rituals, the container practice, opportunities like Zazen, Kai, and Sesshin are definitely essential to my well-being. A friend pointed me toward this book. Can you see this? It's Refuge Recovery by Noah Levine. And he follows the model of the Four Noble Truths, which here are the four truths of refuge recovery, that are addiction creates suffering. The cause of addiction is repetitive craving. Recovery is possible, and the path to recovery is available. So, if we're operating from the premise that anything you use to sedate you or to change your consciousness takes you away from the work of waking up. So, again, I'll repeat that anything you use, the substance that you use to sedate you, takes you from the work of waking up. But the problem is, it's not always easy to see the things that we use. If we do see them, we kind of explain them away or overstate our control over them. So defining intoxicants, it's more than, the usual suspects of drugs and alcohol, even though Surely, back when this was first discussed, they were mostly talking about alcohol or maybe some organic intoxicants. But we can sort of respectfully examine our own assumptions about whether addiction is a disease versus a set of behaviors. And again, with respect to all those who have an intimate relationship with this topic. But there are, also, of course, addictions to smoking cigarettes, and to food and to behavior such as gambling and sex and shopping. Sometimes those addictions feed off of each other. We also contemplate our ideas about moderation, and the precept of do not use intoxicants is often interpreted not as an absolute, but more along the lines of do not become intoxicated. So many recovery programs rely on the premise of absolute abstinence. And some recognize that they might sometimes drink to excess, but not always. And then the complication with, a food addiction is that abstinence obviously doesn't work. We need to eat. I was listening recently, or re-listening to Domio's talk on the Zen Studies podcast about worldly pleasures. It's episode 225 for your reference. And I was thinking of this in relation to this precept, because she makes the point of, what are the drawbacks of worldly pleasures? As lay Buddhists, we're out here in the world, not really necessarily renouncing everything. If you're a monastic, you do. And so the drawbacks of worldly pleasures, such as like imbibing, are related to their impermanent nature. If they were permanently satisfying, it wouldn't be a problem. You wouldn't create craving. So I think of that in terms of this topic. And I also was reading Roshi, Nancy Mujo Baker's, I think it was an article from Tricycle from quite a while ago, but she's the author of Opening to Oneness, which is a book we refer to quite often in terms of the precepts. But she also adds more to that list of intoxicants. She points out that daydreaming, a form of tuning out, is a great intoxicant. Apologizing can be a great intoxicant. Obsessing, being a victim, confusion. And that the odd thing about pleasure is that instead of fully enjoying what is here and being able to be fully present with it, we're busy looking for more. We miss the true depth of pleasure by being intoxicated with the possibility of more. And she goes on to discuss the widespread addiction to modern technology, the life of TV, or now, I guess, more social media scrolling, being a kind of mockery of contemplation. It's like passivity and uncritical, non-critical thinking, inertia. I think she even said we might call this a kind of pseudo samadhi. So not the samadhi that we seek, which is, oneness, connection, vision, spaciousness. I'm always contemplating the word spaciousness. It's sort of a lesser version of that. And, we also think of it back in the 60s when psychedelic use became more prevalent. The idea of achieving a kind of oneness with the universe was sort of like their marketing slogan. But more than just refraining from intoxicants so that we don't speak or act unskillfully, it's also, the refraining from overuse so we don't take our bodies for granted in an unskillful way that ignores the fact of our impermanence. In our guided study group here, we're reading Reb Anderson's Entering the Mind of Buddha, because we are studying the paramitas in relationship to different areas of our lives. And he says that we're intimate with our body and nurture it. It teaches us about interdependence in a very direct and immediate way. When a healthy body is given to us, we may forget that it's subject to impermanence. We become intoxicated with its health and strength, taking it for granted, being overconfident, confident in its enduring nature. Becoming intoxicated this way, as well as in the way we generally conceive of it, we act unskillfully. When we remain aware of the impermanence of health, we will not be intoxicated. In our sober state, we can be filled with joyful gratitude for our health. And this gratitude may in turn help us to be joyfully mindful of the impermanence of our body. Thus, our body becomes a Dharma gift. I also wanted to cite that I had been reading John Dido Laurie on this topic too. And he said, mind is body, body is mind. That's why working with breath is so important in Zazen. If the mind is agitated, the breath is agitated. When the mind is at rest, the breath is deep and easy without hindrance or blockage. One of the precepts in particular points quite clearly to this body-mind continuity, the precept of not clouding the mind. This refers to the need to abstain from drugs, alcohol, or any substance that would defile our inherent purity. So we often run into this question of what would Dogen say? we just heard the Kyoji Kaimon read. One interpretation of the fifth grave precept seems to equate intoxication with ignorance. It says, like, not being ignorant, it has never been, or don't be defiled, it is indeed the great clarity. So what I would hope to do now, because we have so many people in the cloud. We have 32 people in the cloud. And I know that everybody has an experience, whether direct or indirect, with this topic. So here's a couple of things I thought maybe would guide our conversation about this. So I wanted to invite you to consider a couple of things here. I wanted to ask you to consider the ways in which you are addicted to substances or behaviors, including those, or maybe especially those, that we don't as a society consider harmful in moderation. So I'll say that again, the ways in which you're addicted to substances or behaviors, including those that we don't as a society consider harmful in moderation. And then how you view this type of intoxication in relation to your Zen practice. And, if I start, and I said before, I'm very reliant on comfort, on things that bring me comfort. I spend too much time in bed reading. That's my, people have a comfort blanket, or what, child has their blanket. I've got a whole bed. That's where I'm the most comfortable. It's kind of like a safety zone. And I recognize that, sitting in bed reading is not going to be seen as an unhealthy activity in moderation. But I tend to take that to the extreme. I go on bed binges. And I think I've always been this way. I do. We examine ourselves as adults in relation to the children we once were. I see that comfort seeking in myself the need for, I will even say sedation in a certain way, because with, depression comes anxiety. So that comfort really is, it's a magnet. It's a magnet for me. So I'm eager to hear from all of you, or some of you, whoever is wanting to share. And again, I respect everyone's level of comfort with this topic. So feel free to chime in or in the chat too. Candy just said, yep, it's a thing they call bed rotting now. Yes, bed rotting. I bed rot. I do. The only one who's happy about it is my cat. She's very happy about it. Okay, so Annie, if you have a question or you want to start the conversation, feel free to raise your hand in the cloud via the little emoji hand, or in the dirt zendo by, I guess, moving up to the question seat. Rachel?
It wasn't until I started listening to the precepts and realizing what intoxicants really meant that this hit me hard. But daydreaming is a big one. And I remember in therapy, my therapist once said, "I think you have maladaptive daydreaming." And there's really no medication for it, unfortunately. Or if there is, but they haven't tried it on me because she's not, someone who can do that. But it's hard during Zazen because I can't control it anymore. It used to be, you intentionally daydream to avoid the unsafeness. Back when I was in school, I was severely bullied to the point where I developed a complex post-traumatic stress disorder. And daydreaming and reading had became a coping mechanism to get away from being hurt, being severely, severely hurt. And now that I'm older, reading's taken the background. Obviously, it's I don't have time for it anymore. And but daydreaming, I always have time for. You find ways around it, especially if you're doing a monotonous job of just ordering something and you already know what you're ordering and things. But when you're sitting in Zazen and you're trying to focus or not focus or observing but not observing, boy, does that brain like to come up with stories. And they get so intriguing sometimes where it's you fall into a rabbit hole of, well, what is this character going to do next in this adventure and stuff? And it becomes a problem. And it really becomes a problem. And it's not just in Zazen, it happens in the car. And that's dangerous all on its own. Like, you don't, and you wouldn't think that that's a problem. No one would say, "Oh yeah, that's an intoxicant. That's an issue." It is now. It really is. It hinders what you're doing in life. It hinders trying to connect to people because they're not. It's harder to socialize with people when your brain is constantly going, but I know what they're going to say next because we played this scenario before in like a thousand different ways, and it's difficult. It's yeah.
Thank you, Rachel. I think when a doctor or a therapist calls something you do maladaptive, it tends to stick with you. And there's so many things that you want to that you could say that about in most of our human behavior that we like if we do something to excess, it's maladaptive. So, John Butler.
Thank you, Ellen. Intoxicants. Mine include dopamine, serotonin, endorphins, oxytocin, and all the things that I do to hack my brain to get them. But it's like you say, neuroscience says you're supposed to do all the things that generate those chemicals. I mean, from exercise, doing your reading, all sorts of things with friends. So yeah, I definitely crank on those. And the question is, why is that bad? And I think that the root that what Dogen says and whatnot is basically, when you're deluded, when you're not realizing the true nature of reality and stuff like that. So, you're not really necessarily being intimate with life, authentic, one with everything, awake, that kind of stuff. So getting all those chemicals in me just to stay high versus, some higher level thing. So something I got to work on, but it's a very interesting precept.
Thanks. Yeah, brain chemistry. We naturally feed it. Once you start to understand what your particular deficiencies, lack of a better word for me, are, like for me, serotonin is implicated in depression. Or it's not implicated. It is, and I know that because of medications I've tried, and so. Yeah, I mean, who's to say that you shouldn't be trying to improve, that balance? But it's, there's a fine line, I suppose, when you tip into dependence on seeking a high or seeking at least something that brings you like level. If you don't feel level.
I get, like to add one more thing, I guess. It's kind of like the whole red pill, blue pill thing, right? I mean, the blue pill is staying in the matrix, just liking life like everybody else likes it, right? Versus the red pill is seeing reality as it is, getting rid of the delusion. So, I guess we all need to take the red pill.
Aurelin?
Of all the precepts, this one kind of, I was like, oh, like obviously, and like intoxication, like don't drink too much. But the more I think about it, the more it kind of dawns on me. Addictive personality does run in my family. Most of my uncles on my father's side have been self-destructive alcoholics, chain smokers. Like my father refuses to touch alcohol in any form because he's seen what it's done to his family. I don't have an addictive relationship with alcohol. Like once in a while I'll have a drink or so. I tend to avoid it for so it doesn't affect my medication, but for me, I mean, I am obsessive compulsive, so I am addicted to behavior. And it's behavior that seems on the surface to be helpful. Like it seems like it feels in the moment that I'm protecting myself from some imagined consequence of failure. But I'm just working myself, I'm wearing myself down to a nub. Like I'm trying, I'm perceiving imaginary threats that I am like burning myself out trying to prevent this imaginary danger from happening, where if I did nothing, no danger is coming. So I'm fighting an imaginary enemy all the time, and I'm addicted to protecting myself from something that's not even actually there. Oh my gosh, and I guess, the behaviors, even the ones society does not view as harmful, like it seems on the surface that, yeah, like preventing catastrophe, this is a good thing. No one wants to suffer. We all want to protect ourselves from suffering. But in my life, the overprotectiveness produces its own suffering in place of the suffering that it supposedly protects me from. I guess that's all I've got. This kind of rattled me unexpectedly.
No, I mean, me too. That's why I said, like, I was deluded in thinking that, like, what? I'm not an addict. Of course I am. And it's hard to, like, even think in terms of, like, survival in this time, difficult time, without relying on certain habits that might be less than stellar, you know, especially in excess, and that it serve as intoxicants or sedatives. Jinryu.
This is I applaud your taking this on, Ellen. I find this particular precept hard to get my head around. And I will say that I'm one of the ones you alluded to in the beginning, who has intimate familiarity with addiction. And thank God it is no longer a problem. But the reason why it's hard for me to get this precept out of, to get my head around it is, considering where I came from, the idea of any other kind of habitual behavior, you know, I would not be the one reading in bed with my cat. I would be the one reading in my comfy chair with my cats. But it's the same thing. That is light years from where I was. And so I can't connect those two personally. What I can connect, though, is addiction to something that is not an obvious intoxicant. And by that, I mean specifically in the past, I had a friend who was anorexic and bulimic. And she was a friend of mine after her recovery. I did not know her when she was in the throes of her addiction. I have a friend today who has food addictions and goes to 12-step meetings to address them and has had great success. And it is hard for me to connect with those two things because, you know, I might be stuffing chocolate cake down my face at one moment and then running to the bathroom to get rid of it in another moment, but I can still drive a car. And I might have, you know, I might spend hours in bed on a rainy, cold Saturday reading with my cats. But if I have to, I can still get up and run to the grocery store and get back safely. So, you know, I think that's probably why I've never, pre and I would love to hear what others have to say about that. I think that's probably why I've never presented this precept. Because I just go off the edge so fast and I can't reconnect, can't connect, I should say, with other things. The anorexic and bulimic aspect is very hard to understand, but it is an addiction, as I understand it, as I was told by this friend, it's an addiction to power. So these things that we get hooked on that cloud our minds and just drive our lives, it's amazing. That's all. Thanks.
Thanks, Jimmy. Yeah, and again, with the equivalency, there is none, right? So when I talk about my own overindulgences, the point of them is avoidance. The point of them is pushing reality away for a moment or an hour or a day. And so I don't drink because it doesn't agree with me, but I'm sure if it did, I would be subject to it. I could see it. You know, if it didn't make me sick and made me feel better, it might have been more of a problem as it is. Like other things took its place in my life in terms of avoiding what I don't want to face at any given moment. Candy.
I think that when you're looking at, for me, and granted, I'm very, very new to all this. When I consider this precept, there are two things that stand out to me. There's impact and then there's intention. And that's what I heard when Jinryu was sharing, is that the impact of certain addictions are seen and felt. And so they're more readily recognized as addiction because we see the impact physically and mental and emotional health are still very important things. Spiritual health to me are very important things. They have impact. And I think about intention. And I think for me, if I look at this precept from intention, I can definitely recognize that the urge to pick up a drink stems from the same place as the urge to not leave my bed and stay there for days with a book, or to just say, I am not stepping foot out of my house for a while because I can't face the world out there. It's stemming from the same motivation of I want to close my eyes and ears and everything because I can't face reality, or I need a little help to distort reality because I can't face it. It's too hard, whatever it is that I'm using to do that. And so I think that's why when you, and then people say, well, yeah, but it doesn't hurt you to sit in your bed all day and never go anywhere. It does. It does. Mental and emotional and spiritual health are still very important things, and social health is still very important. And when you are alone, and you have no one around you because you've decided to isolate yourself because you couldn't face the world, it's a real thing. And so that's what this precept says to me. And I'll be very honest, it's the most daunting of all the precepts for me. Facing reality, facing this world is very scary to me. The world is very scary. I've always very, the moment I heard that life is suffering, I knew that Buddhism was for me. I said, oh yeah, no shit, Sherlock. Excuse my French. So, frankly, it's why I struggle with the idea of taking Jukai because I'm so scared to face the world. And then, you know, I know we take refuge. We take refuge in the Sangha. We take refuge in the Dharma. We take refuge in the Buddha so that we can face reality. But it is very hard. That's all I have to say. And I think, is somebody in the dirt zendo sitting in the question chair? I can't tell.
Yes, thank you, Candy. Thank you so much. That idea of intention is really, you know, who is it, who is this hurting kind of thing, and me being in bed. You know, I have two boys who are now, you know, adultish, but they're college age, but they saw me like this through most of their lives. And it's not that I wasn't up and making them food and taking them a million places. I was. I did all those things. And then, like a magnet, I would get back in the bed. So, that I never know how that has affected their view of the world or their view of avoidance versus facing reality. Alice, is that you in the chair?
Yep, it's me.
Hi.
But yeah, there's been some great stuff that I wanted. I think I might be repeating some other things that other people have been talking about, but I think this precept points to us the polarity of addiction to things, behaviors, objects, in that it points to what we fear. Like, kind of going on the avoidance thing. I mean, I have friends who are the opposite of what Candy spoke about. They are constantly out there. They're super extroverted. They're going from party to party to party, relationship to relationship to relationship, activity to activity to activity, basically chasing dopamine. When I can see as their friend that they are running away from something so desperately, either it's a conversation with their spouse or facing some kind of familial problem at home or whatnot, but the common link that I see a lot here is, well, avoidance, but also pointing towards, like, well, what are you fearing? What are you. Why are you pulling the wool over your eyes? And that question can only be answered by yourself. For me, I know plenty of people who are addicted to exercise. I'm sort of kind of one of them, but not as bad as I've seen others. And to be frank, that's fear of stagnation and fear of sedentary, like immobility or death, that keeps me going. But again, it's not bad. It's not like a true addiction in a sense. But I can see how this precept kind of awakens you to the things that you might be fearing and avoiding. That's all.
Thank you. Yeah, absolutely. Like, fear is so present in my life. I'm aware of it consciously, of being afraid. And so that being afraid for like the welfare of my kids has always been a big, big, big one, almost too big to even contemplate. And more than my own welfare. So yeah, so I like might be avoiding, and it's like a bravery to be able to really face your what the fears are, where they come from. I'm not even sure I have the bravery, but most of the time. But as I said, all of the practice that we do, or the things that how we apply, like we were talking about the paramitas and guided practice group, how we apply them to each of the different kind of realms of our life. I have to kind of take time to think about that too.
Ellen,
Yes, we're there.
I appreciate the gentle way you've approached this. I thought, well, this precept is good. It's so complicated. I'll just nod to it because, oh yeah. But so I'm glad you are handling this, as I say, with compassion. It would not be considered a fault, my multitasking, but I see it can be a way of not being a good listener, not being present, even though it may not be harming anyone other than myself. And I just think, oh, I can go for a walk without doing Alexander technique. But it's such a habit that I tell myself, oh, of course, this is more secure or whatever, or isn't this good? I can do two things at once. But then, how present am I allowing myself? But, you know, anything can be a vice to an extreme. I mean, a virtue can be a vice. So thank you for presenting this in such a open, compassionate manner.
Thanks, Ruthann. Yeah, virtue versus vice is like probably, you know, that middle way, moderation. That's where that is it at play. You know, I don't know that that's always the case. There's some things that are probably don't do that if you can help it, but some that are, if it's not hurting, maybe it's helping. Yeah, I think a lot of this conversation falls into that category. Jinri, you have your hand up?
Yeah, just one last thing very briefly. And, you know, this happens to me every year. And so my personal vow in front of all of you is that when this precept is presented next year, I will not say a word. And the reason why is because I go over that edge so quickly. But when I reread what this precept is about, it doesn't say don't become addicted. That's almost a given. But for some of us, those of us who are addicted or have been addicted, that's not a given. It's a fact of life. Like I have a heart condition. Thank God I don't. But it's that factual. It's that black and white. But it's saying, don't become intoxicated. Work on being clear. Work on getting rid of delusion. And of course, everything that comes out of our mouth, everything that comes out of my mouth is a fabrication. Not harboring delusions is the precept of not becoming intoxicated. So, I mean, I've come full circle to believe it is far more like what you have been talking about, Ellen, and Rachel, I believe it was, started talking about as well. These conversations we have, I know where this is going. I'm going to get caught up in it again because I know what you're thinking. Well, the fact of the matter is I don't know what you're thinking. So this precept is just so much broader than where I go with it, but I guess I can't help it. So there we are.
All valid. I mean, absolutely. But I always love hearing your perspective on it, even if it isn't, you know, a very complex thing that, as you said, sends you over the edge. I get that. Dirt Zendo, is that Erica in the chair?
Yeah, it's me. Hi, Ellen.
Hi.
I've always thought of myself as a very disciplined person, especially when it comes to what I eat and drink. And so my seemingly innocent thing that basically became an addiction was, you know, once I had my twins, it was like I had no time for myself, right? Like just every second of my day was taken up taking care of them or doing cleaning the house or something that was not about me. And so I got into the habit of once the twins would go to bed, I would have a snack and a glass of wine. And, you know, I've just done that for the last 5.5 years since they've been born. And I look forward to it so much. Like they will literally be sitting there screaming and I'm like, I can't wait until they go to bed. You know, like I can have my glass of wine, I can have my snack. But so I can't stop. I've been trying for like the last several months to stop. Because I'm like, they're getting older, it's not so hard anymore, and I can't stop. And I had to kind of examine it, like, why can't I do this? And I feel like a lot of it has to do with just having to shove so much of myself onto the back burner all the time. You know, like, what I want to do, and, like, you know, I don't have the energy for this, but I have to push myself to do it anyway. And to just sit there when they go to bed and do nothing just doesn't feel like enough. And I wish it did, you know, like, keep hearing like, oh, just find other ways to relax. And I'm like, I'm so tired. I can't, there's nothing else I could do. I mean, I'm sure there is, but I just can't come up with it yet. So it's been interesting because, I, like I said, I'm usually so disciplined about that, and I just can't shut it off right now. So, yeah, that's where I'm at.
Yeah, I remember that same exact feeling and impulse when my kids were little. It's like, it must be universal, like needing the relief of having some time to yourself, you know, after they go to sleep or before they wake up, whatever it is. I remember sitting, my kids had like little mini armchairs on the floor, like beanbag chairs. I would sit in one of their chairs and like eat snacks on the floor. I was eating like Honey Nut Cheerios out of the box, you know, just because it was like just relief.
I do that too. I raid all their snacks, like goldfish and cheeses, all of it.
Absolutely. And I was right there with you 18, 19 years ago. Yeah. That's like a parenthood or motherhood. It's a minute to the hour. Does anybody have any other questions, contributions, thoughts? Said Isaac, hi.
Hi, Alan.
Hi.
Thank you for presenting. This has been very good. Thank you for everyone who shared and everyone being here. I'll try to be brief. I can really connect with a lot of what's been said from like the whole spectrum. I am in recovery. I've been for a long time for addiction, and I also have complex PTSD, but I can also relate to like iPad in bed with my cat, like, so I can kind of relate to all of that. But I think what's really coming up for me with this precept is my addiction to myself. Whether it's a negative view of myself or a positive view of myself, but just really being obsessed with myself.
Thank you. Yeah, that's a tough one.
Yeah. Thanks for that, Isaac.
Yeah, right. I know, I'm just going to ponder that for the rest of the
day. Thanks for leaving us with that.
Can you say it like it's
a yeah, well, we, you know, I don't know. I mean, I want to give that some thought. Are we all obsessed with ourselves? Or you think we have a pathological degree? Yeah, okay, John says, yeah, thumbs up.
I think so for sure. Yeah.
If you're not obsessed with yourself, what are you going to be obsessed about? I don't know.
How great I am for not being obsessed with myself.
Yeah, where my kids now, like being an empty nester, I thought, oh, there's this tremendous void here. Right. And it's true. Like all the cliches are true. More time to think about myself. Well, who wants that? You know, but it's true. Thanks, Isaac.
Thank you.
I would like to just jump in this last minute and actually, I'm grateful to Zen for allowing this platform, but we live in an addicted society, and it has been. I mean, we have the generational history, and luckily I know and have known some beautiful 90-year-olds. And they seem to, in their own lifestyle, wherever their health is, to cognitively come to the delusions we've all been kind of hanging on to as just very freeing to be able to face them. Of course, if you're in your 90s, you're not responsible, you know, for anyone else other than yourself. But still, it's very comforting to know such sweet souls. And thank you for this evening.
Thank you, Ruthann. Anybody else? Are we ready to close? Closing? Okay. We dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thanks,
thank you,
everyone.
Thank you, Ashley, for staying up so late.